This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest Gina Davis knew she wanted to be an actor pretty much her whole life. When she plucked up the courage to tell her parents her plan, they were surprisingly cool with it.
When I said I want to major in acting at BU, they were like, oh, okay. As if I'd said something you could get a job in, you know. And then when I eventually did get a job, my first job was in Tootsie. It was my first audition, even. I remember I came home to visit, and my mom and the neighbor were talking. My best friend's mother were talking, and she was saying, like, we can't believe it. Nobody can believe it. This is crazy. And my mom said, what? She studied acting in college.
I guess that's how it works. It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Gina Davis. The Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media studies how to combat stereotypes and achieve gender balance in movies and TV. That's something Gina's been working toward for 14 years now. The campaign even includes movie nights at home.
There have been times when I start to lean over. My daughter's now 14, when I lean over to say something, and she says, I know, I noticed, not enough girls. I saw that right away.
She and I will talk about working in film, making yourself heard, and getting into archery. She is super good at archery. Then later, I'll talk to the Emmy-winning comedian and showrunner Louis C.K. His new show, Horace and Pete, was created in secret with big-time actors, including Jessica Lange, Steve Buscemi, and Alan Alda. Louis shot the show in his own way.
I've learned that it's okay for an actor to get upset and go back to their trailer and go, oh my God, this is intense. They'll be okay. Pressure's good for performers, you know?
Plus, I'll tell you about the website I've been checking back in on regularly for almost 20 years. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. When Gina Davis starred in Thelma and Louise, it looked like a breakthrough. Oscar nominations, huge box office. It had to be the start of a trend, right? Finally, women could star in buddy movies. But it didn't work out that way. Same thing happened when she starred in A League of Their Own. Acclaim, box office smash, but no more female sports movies. When her first daughter was a young child, Davis started wondering how many women were in the kids' shows she was seeing. She started the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media to find out. The results of that first study were discouraging, and so were the results of the second. The Institute's been studying the sexism in entertainment for 8 years now, first at USC's Annenberg School of Communications, now at Mount St. Mary's University. Gina Davis, it is great to have you on the show. Welcome to Bullseye.
Thank you so much.
Let's start by talking about the Institute, and we'll get into your career later. But you're clearly a person who goes into things whole hog.
Right.
As evidenced by the fact that you once almost became an Olympic archer. But and we're definitely going to talk about that.
Okay.
But what led you into this work in such a sort of broad and deep way?
Well, it is a tendency of mine to go too far with everything. But I didn't intend to with this in the beginning. After I noticed how bereft of female presence kids entertainment seemed to be, I just started asking people about it. I asked my friends, you know, if they noticed that the movie that just came out had only one female character in it after the mother dies gruesomely, of course, in the first 5 minutes. And none of them noticed. So I thought, well, you know, I'm in the industry. I meet a bunch of people. I'll just ask people about it and see what the thinking is. And if I had a meeting with a studio executive or producer, director, whatever, I'd say, have you ever noticed how few female characters there are in G and PG rated movies? And every single person I asked said, no, that's not true anymore. That's not a problem anymore. And they were very sincere about it and actually passionate about it. They weren't saying, it's not a big deal. They said, we care about that here. We work on it. We talk about it all the time. And we made – and they would name a movie with one female character as proof that gender inequality had been fixed. So this was very striking to me that the people creating this stuff had no idea how few female characters there were. So that's what made me think – maybe if I had the numbers, it would make a difference. And that started the whole thing.
I mean, it is something that I think, you know, because of a combination of a sexist society and my own male privilege, it's easy for me not to think of. But if I think of the movies that my sons watch, I mean, like Toy Story is a beautiful, fantastic movie.
Absolutely.
Like a real, genuine 4-star movie. But like it's like Bo Peep.
Keep going.
Like they added one or two more. There's Barbie. I don't think they added her till later. But anyway, it is kind of a terrifying thing. Was it something that you had thought about in your own work prior to having that realization about the stuff your daughter was watching?
Well, I was certainly aware that there were fewer really great parts for women. But I think anybody, if you ask them, are there fewer starring roles for women? I think your average moviegoer would say, well, yeah, it seems so. But certainly in the earlier days, I was getting a lot of really great parts. And my whole impression was things are getting better. And then, like you said, the thing happened with Thelma and Louise and League of Their Own, and I thought, now everything's getting fixed and it's all good. And it took me quite a while to realize that things weren't getting better, because part of it is you expect things to get better, but part of it is the press kept saying, now things are better. When there was a movie that struck it big starring women, like I remember when First Wives Club came out, oh, this fixes everything now. 50-year-old women can lead movies and whatever. And you sort of buy it. So it took a while until I started seeing interviewers always wanted to know, are things getting better for women? And I said, well, it seems like it. You know, it took me a while to say, I don't know. You know, Google it. Find out.
Were you usually answering interviews in like the voice of a cornpone guy and overalls?
I know. That's a weird impression of myself, right? Kind of, oh, shucks, Ernest. Yeah, I think so.
One of the most interesting things about the studies that the Institute has done, and one that really took my breath away when I first heard about it when it came out a couple of years ago, was a study of the gender distribution in crowd scenes. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that?
Well, it's bad in speaking characters. It's a really bad ratio. But in crowd scenes, particularly in animated movies, it's far worse than the speaking characters. In some animated movies, the crowd scenes are only 17% female characters, which is
what?
Absurd. It's like, what? I know. It's really inexplicable. So in fiction, especially stuff for kids, it's all invented, you know, outer space colonies or underwater kingdoms or whatever. And the female population could be that low. I don't know how to explain it, except my theory is that Hollywood writers think women don't gather.
Well, I mean, I think what it really speaks to is that it is a fundamental structural issue, that it's not necessarily about malevolent actors.
Not at all.
And I don't mean actors as in actors doing acting, but people doing things. It's right. Not about malevolent people.
Right.
It's about a fundamental problem where,
right.
You know, even something as neutral as a crowd right. is so profoundly imbalanced.
Right, right. And I think it's attributable to unconscious bias, because when I had the numbers and I went back to the studios, you know, I'd say, can I talk to everybody? And their jaws were on the ground. They were stunned. They had no idea. But wanted to change it. You know, there's been so much change just as a result of the meetings that we take that it's really heartening. When this is a good example of what you're talking about. When I was doing Stuart Little, there's a scene where there's a boat race with remote control boats. And I was watching as the assistant director was setting it up, and he'd choose a little boy and give him a remote and have him sit down on the edge of the water, and then choose a little girl behind each boy. And I saw what he was doing, and I just went over and casually said, "Hey, do you think we could give half of the remotes to girls?" And he like slapped his forehead, and I was like, "Oh, yes, of course," and switched it. It felt so stupid that he hadn't thought of it himself. But no, but I promise you, nobody thinks of it themselves unless, you know, it gets pointed out.
How does this touch your life? And we'll leave aside your working life for a minute. But how do you feel like it touches your home life? I mean, I'm sure you have three kids.
Right.
I'm sure they watch film and television some anyway.
Yeah.
So how do you think about responding to it as a parent?
Well, what I've done from the beginning, and I actually recommend this to folks who ask, is I watch with them whenever possible. When they were little, I always watched everything with them. And, you know, I limit what they see, of course, but they see what other kids see generally. But I can be their, window into the unreality of what they're seeing. I can point out things that will mitigate that impact. So I'll say, "Hey, did you notice there's only one girl in that group? Why do you think that is? Or do you think girls could do what those boys are doing? Or why do you think she's wearing that if she's going to go rescue somebody? That seems inappropriate." So they are actually they are pretty media savvy now, I have to say. They notice it themselves. They point it out to me all the time.
Do they get annoyed with you about it?
No. No, although there have been times when I start to lean over. My daughter's now 14. When I lean over to say something, and she says, "I know, I noticed, not enough girls. I saw that right away." So, they're very attuned to it.
So once you and the scholars who work on these studies do the counting, what are the things that you then do with the numbers besides being kind enough to come talk to me on Bullseye here?
Right.
But what else are you doing with those, with that information that you're gathering?
Well, the number one thing we do is meet with everyone who creates children's media. So we visit all the studios, all the networks, all the guilds, production companies, pretty much everybody. We try to saturate Hollywood, and we've been doing it a while now. So we visited most places many times and try to hit all their divisions, like Disney. I can't even count how many times we've been over there. They have us back over and over and over. They have lots of divisions, of course. And they want us to talk to all of them. They are not at all skeptical, first of all. They believe in the research. And people who make kids' media, I think, do feel a sense of obligation to, you know, make sure that it's good for kids. And they had no idea they were sending such a negative message to kids about the value of girls. So we've seen a lot of improvement already.
There's now two girl dogs on Paw Patrol. That's a 100% increase.
Wow.
That's breaking news from the parenting front lines, Gina Davis.
That's fabulous. Probably I had something to do with it. I have to guess.
Yeah. I mean, you went up to Canada and you gave those Paw Patrollers a taste of your mind.
That's right. That's exactly
need a,
right.
A husky named Everest.
Right. But it's much more efficient to use the research that way instead of trying to, you know, educate the entire populace. It's efficient and they don't feel threatened. I never bust anybody publicly or talk about a particular movie that didn't do a good job. So it's a great relationship.
Tell me why you've chosen that path. Why don't you bust people publicly or talk about particular shows that do a bad job, like Paw Patrol?
But look, they just made a nice improvement. We have to encourage modest
work. Good work, Paw Patrol.
I don't think in this case it would work that well. I was very aware that the Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, they all publish the numbers every year. They have women's committees on the, you know, in the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild and whatever. And the numbers never seem to move. In fact, the percentage of female characters in films has been exactly the same since 1946. So we're talking about 7 decades of stagnation, utter stagnation. So I felt that I had to try a different kind of approach. And plus, I want to keep working for these people. So, you know, I keep a very friendly relationship with everybody.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor Gina Davis. She's been an advocate for gender equality and representation in Hollywood, and she founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. She also founded the Bentonville Film Festival, which promotes women and diverse voices in film. The festival takes place this week. I feel like I read a story about you showing up to work on Thelma and Louise and realizing that all of your notes about your character were like a setup based on how can I use being nice to convince Ridley Scott to change this.
Right.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So we were going to have a meeting with just Susan and I and Ridley. I'd never met Susan yet. And just go over, do we have any thoughts or things we wanted to change or whatever. And I had planned out everything that I wanted to change by deciding how I would bring it up. So this one, I could probably say this as a joke, but he might understand the truth behind it, or maybe I can make him think this one is his idea. This one I'll just bring up on the set quietly. This one I'll just do without telling him I'm going to do it. You know, and so all this kind of girly, non-threatening ways that I could make sure there wasn't the slightest possibility he would think I was arrogant or, you know, had ideas of my own, basically, because my number one goal in life was that everybody like me. I would never any problem. And so we show up and I meet Susan. She's so impressive. And sit down. And I swear, I think it was on page one, she said, now, this first line I have, I don't think I should say that. Let's just cut that line. How about that? Or we can put it on page two, whichever you like. And my mouth was just hanging. I couldn't believe. And it's ridiculous that I would be in my 30s and feel like this. But I'd never seen a woman behave like that before, to just say what she thought without first saying, you know, if you don't mind, maybe you'd like this or maybe you won't, you know, and just say it. And of course, he reacted completely normally and said, oh, yeah, or no, let's do this instead or whatever. And the entire movie was like that for me. It was just a total lesson in how to be yourself, how to actually, you know, just say things and have an opinion and that it's okay.
Do you feel like you were afraid to do that when you were younger?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I was very shy, but I think I was shy because I didn't want to volunteer opinions or take a stance, you know, that I'll just be very shy and that's how I'll be able to remain non-threatening and everything. It was definitely a part of my personality for a long time. My whole life has been an adventure in how to, you know, rise above that and conquer it.
If this is a weird question, don't answer it. But you're like 6 foot tall or so. When you were like a teenager.
Yeah.
I don't know when you got to be as tall as you are. But
when I was a baby.
Okay. but when you were like a teenager, were you comfortable in your body and were you comfortable with the kind of just impact that you made being taller than most of the other women that were around you?
No.
And a lot of the other dudes,
and
too?
Most of the other dudes? All of the women and the vast majority of the dudes I was taller than. No, I wasn't comfortable. I think my fondest wish was to take up less space in the world. And
you understand that's a pretty unusual thing for a professional performer to say.
I know, but I really was self-conscious. I didn't want to try sports because I was afraid of being laughed at or that, you know, that I was sure I must be uncoordinated. I just didn't want to try anything. And, I was very, very self-conscious. And then even the few times that I would let myself out of the box or something, somebody would say, oh, you laugh too loud. That's very unattractive. You should laugh more quietly. And I'm like, how much more quiet can I get? But that was always the message. Don't wear those shoes. I made a lot of my own clothes. Don't wear clothes like that. Just don't be you. And I tried not to.
What kind of clothes did you make?
A lot of things. You know, I just have a very vivid imagination and I made a lot of crazy stuff. I made things out of leather and suede and I don't know.
Give me examples, please.
Okay. I one time made, those really, it was like a jumpsuit with really, really wide legs. That was kind of in style when I was in high school. Very, very wide.
Sort of like something Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire
yes,
would wear.
Yes, exactly. And one side was solid green and one side was had a green background but had polka dots on it. And then, of course, the first thing somebody said was, you look like a circus clown. And I had to get through the day without going home and changing. But
I'm pretty impressed here. One thing that I'm impressed with is that for a young woman whose stated desire was to be smaller in the world, that you were making circus clown clothing for yourself.
Clown pants, right. Well, I know. It's true.
I mean, I want to be clear. Like, I support circus clown clothing. But
it's absolutely true. I don't know. I think I just wasn't good at blending into the – like I really wanted to, but or I was trying to thwart myself unconsciously or something. But I had – you know, I was so tall, but then I had platform shoes. I had great big ones with like a rainbow on them or something. And I remember at a church youth group meeting, the junior pastor asked – asked one of the guys, what kind of girl would you like picture yourself dating? And he said, well, I'm not sure. I just know she wouldn't be wearing those shoes. I made it through high school without having a boyfriend, let's just say.
Did you think of yourself as good looking?
No, really not. But I held out hope because my best friend's mother constantly told me I was pretty and that I would realize that later. And I thought she was crazy, but I had the secret hope that maybe adults will think I am somehow. In this distant future, somehow I'll become attractive.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor Gina Davis, who's founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media and the Bentonville Film Festival. Were you performing as a teenager?
No, I didn't want to be in the drama club or do. It was kind of a secret. I announced to my parents when I was 3 that I was going to be in movies, but I kept it pretty close to the vest.
It's really hard to get in movies without telling anyone.
It is, but I figured I'd had no clue that you could get in movies without going to college first. And so I figured I'll just study acting in college and then it'll all work out.
So what was the first time you you came out as an aspiring performer?
It was the first time I performed, actually.
Yeah, like when did you actually admit to the world that this was what you wanted for yourself?
Well, I was very into music. I was in every chorus and choir, and I played the piano and the flute and the pipe organ, and I took the music teacher in high school aside and said, where do you go to college if you want to be an actor? And he said, oh, Boston University. And so that was it for me. I didn't have to ask anybody else. That's what I wanted to do, and I eventually ended up there.
Not like Juilliard or something.
No, I mean,
no offense to Boston University.
No, but that's what he said.
It's just an unusually specific.
It was. It was extremely specific.
At the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Right.
BU.
Maybe that's what small town music teachers would think of rather than Juilliard.
Was there a point when you were like late in your teens, early in your 20s, when you realized that it was something that you actually could do?
Well, embarrassingly, I was 100% positive the entire time. Absolutely
really?
Positive. Yeah, that's what I was going to do. I had no backup plan. My parents were unsophisticated enough not to force me to have a backup plan. I mean, we had no clue about anything to do with anything like this. My parents were from Vermont, you know, very small town, grow your own food, build your own house kind of people. And when I said I want to major in acting at BU, they were like, oh, okay. As if I'd said something you could get a job in, you know. And then when I eventually did get a job, my first job was in Tootsie. It was my first audition even. I remember I came home to visit and my mom and the neighbor were talking. My best friend's mother were talking and she was saying, I can't believe it. Nobody can believe it. This is crazy. And my mom said, "What? She studied acting in college." So we were kind of like, yeah, well, that was what was supposed to happen.
Why don't we listen to a scene, you, my guest Gina Davis, in Tootsie from 1982. So Dustin Hoffman's character has just been cast on a soap opera. He auditioned as a woman, and he meets April, one of the other actors on the show, played by my guest Gina Davis. And Dustin's character speaks first. He's a bit flustered by April walking into the dressing room in her underwear.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, it's quite all right.
I'm April Page. How are you?
My, what a nice looking table.
Really?
Yes, it's very smooth. And that's a very good idea, a socket for a plug.
Yeah, well, we get everything.
Yes, I see.
Just push all that stuff out of the way. Make yourself at home, okay?
Dum-de-dum-de-dum. Yes.
One more thing, Miss Michaels. I forgot to give you these.
Thank you. Oh, are these for today?
Yes.
Well, they always throw stuff into the last minute. You could leave your mind around here.
Oh, my goodness.
What's wrong?
I have to kiss Dr. Brewster.
Oh, yeah. He kisses all the women on the show. We call him the tongue.
When you got to the movie,
yeah,
I think that's the expression they use, did you feel like you could do it?
I did. I was a little nervous coming in. I didn't know. I'd never, you know, obviously been on a set. I thought they would expect me to know where to stand or how, you know, what to do. But I was pretty confident. Yeah. In fact, we shot that the first thing on my first day, and while we were shooting that, the take they used is where Dustin accidentally walked into the door. But, you know, we just kept going and I ad-libbed something or whether. And after that, Sidney Pollack said, come over here. Why are you not nervous? I don't know. I just not. And he's like, it's very strange, but it's great. But it's very strange that you're not nervous. But I'm just, I've never had nerves about it.
Did you feel by then, like your appearance was not going to embarrass you?
Well, I had gone through a whole period before that for a couple of years as a model because nobody said at BU how you're supposed to get a job in the movies. And I went to New York instead of L.A. because nobody told me you should go to L.A. instead. So my big plan was I'll become a model. And then they'll just offer me parts, like Christie Brinkley was getting parts and stuff. Because, of course, it's much easier to become a supermodel than an actor. So
sure.
I didn't, but I did work. I did, you know, catalogs, and I was on the cover of New Jersey Monthly. And
congratulations.
Things like that, yes.
I heard you were something called a living mannequin. Is
that
true?
I was. I pretended to be a mannequin in store windows.
And please explain that.
Okay. So I was working at Ann Taylor on Fifth Avenue and as a sales girl. And we always dressed in the clothes of the store. And one day there were mannequins sitting at a table eating plastic lunch in the clothes. And there was one empty chair. And I said, dare me to go in the window to the other girls. And I didn't need them to dare me. I just decided to go in the window and then just freeze. And people stopped and to see what I was going to do, and then I just didn't move. I'd never thought about whether I had an ability with motionlessness or not, but I just sat there and didn't move. And more people kept gathering and couldn't figure out because they hadn't seen me walk in, they couldn't figure out what they were looking at. And the other people were like, just wait. And then maybe after 5 or 10 minutes, I moved. And what? And then more people gathered. Anyway, the manager came and said, Gina, what are you? Get out of the window. What are you doing? And then she saw the big crowd and she said, no, stay in the window. And so they hired me from then on to be in the window on the weekends. And then other stores did too. But anyway, modeling plan. yes. Oh, because you asked me about did I decide that I was attractive.
Yeah.
So what I decided was, because I was getting, you know, $200 an hour back in the day, was unbelievable to be a model. And I decided that I knew how to trick people into thinking I was attractive. So I had decided that I was attractive, but that it was a trick.
I mean, here in the radio industry, we're known for our good looks.
Absolutely.
But, less so than in, you know, movie stars.
Right.
So it's just – it's like – it's really interesting to me just this kind of like what's it like basically. And I feel like there's – it would be weird if your identity was tied up in how good looking you are. But at the same time, I think in any profession where you are looked at as part of your job, especially if you're a woman where you're looked at as part of your gender, it is, you know, it must be very difficult to maintain some distance between what you have done by choice and what has been given to you by nature and the weird, gross, dark stuff about people looking at you.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And so it's the best I could do, too. I'm a professional. I've been doing this 15 years.
I'm not sure what to say. I'm not sure I even – I'm sorry.
There may not have been a question. but, I mean, it sounds like partly what you were looking for was a way to have an identity that included your own agency, that you were doing something.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about that.
Is that possible?
That's
true?
Possible. Yeah.
Should I check with your therapist?
No, but I will be. Okay. That's really interesting, huh? It's possible. It's possible.
Did you like being a movie star?
You know, here's what I think about that, about being recognized and everything. It's for me, it's never been at a level that's uncomfortable, where I'd have to actually leave somewhere or avoid something because of being noticed. I go to restaurants, I go to the movies, I do anything I want and always have. And if people recognize me, they say something nice 99% of the time. And they just want to say, I like you or I like your work or whatever. And this is a very nice thing. And a lot of times it's a very positive thing. Somebody – I might be in a line and the person before me gets treated rudely and then all of a sudden I'm treated really nice. So I try to be very grateful that I get the good version of people most of the time.
It seems like you've also had some of your landmark works, Thelma and Louise, A League of Their Own, Tootsie. Those are all movies that, in addition to being great movies, are movies that really impacted people's lives and identities in a way that I don't know what's – maybe Titanic didn't do as much. Mm. You know, like I have friends – I have a friend who's in – she's probably 30-ish and plays baseball. And I don't think that there's like a more important thing in the world to her than A League of Their Own. Mm. So it must be that when you – I presume that when you interact with people often, that's an element of it, that you've been in these things that ended up being important to people.
Mm-hmm. It's a very special thing, you know. I'm so grateful that I was in played some roles that meant something to people. It was a huge change when people started recognizing me from Thelma and Louise. Like, we had no idea anybody was going to react the way they did. No clue. And total surprise. And so before, you know, people might say, hey, the Beetlejuice, the fly, whatever. This is my bug phase. But
two great movies.
Great movies, right? But when people recognized me from that movie, they wanted to talk about it. They had passionate ideas and feelings about it. And then League of Their Own, it was young women or girls saying, I play sports because of that movie. And who knew that movies were going to live as long as they do now? You know, Thelma and Louise is 25 this year and League of Their Own will be 25 next year. But I had the same number of women come up to me and say they play sports because of League of Their Own as when it first came out. So
you yourself took up sports as an adult.
Yes.
What were the circumstances?
I was a very late-blooming athlete. Yeah, so I was, like I said, I was very physically shy as a kid. And then I got cast in League of Their Own, and I had to play the best baseball player anyone has ever seen. And so we had coaches, you know, very major league coaches, very professional people. And I trained, you know, as hard as I could, tried as hard as I could. And they soon started saying, wow, you have natural athletic ability. And I was like, I do? It was so exciting. And I learned how to play really good movie baseball. And then I had other parts where I learned special skills also, like Cutthroat Island and Long Kiss Goodnight. I learned sword fighting and pistol shooting and ice skating and taekwondo and all kinds of stuff. And I was good at all of those too. And so that's what made me think I want to take up a sport in real life and not just the movie version of it, you know.
She did take up a sport, and she almost made it to the Olympics in archery. We'll hear all about that when I continue my conversation with Gina Davis after a break. Plus, comedian Louis C.K. has won a bunch of Emmy Awards by taking his creative career into his own hands and running his own TV shows. We'll talk about why he's not scared to commit lots of time and millions of dollars to his creative vision. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message comes from The Black Tux, the new way to rent a tuxedo. The Black Tux designs and manufactures handsome modern suits, far from the polyester mess you'll get at that mall rental stand. Select from complete looks or build your own. The suit will arrive 7 days before your event, which leaves plenty of time to try it on. If the fit needs a tweak, the Black Tux will do whatever it takes to fix it in time. Shipping is free both ways. If you need to rent a suit or a tuxedo for an upcoming wedding or special event, you don't have to do it the old-fashioned way. Visit theblacktux.com/bullseye and experience a new way to rent. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Let me introduce you to NPR Music's discovery podcast, Alt Latino. Hosts Felix Contreras and Jasmine Gard are your guides into the world of Latino arts and culture. And they're not taking a stodgy museum tour. Alternative approaches to traditional music, interviews with cultural icons like Rita Moreno and Carlos Santana, as well as contemporary vanguards like Calle 13 and Juno Diaz. Find Alt Latino at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is Bullseye. I'm talking to the actor Gina Davis, who founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. So, as we were saying before the break, you ended up taking up archery pretty seriously. What was it like for you when you started trying to do that?
Well, embarrassingly, my coach says this is true. I don't remember this. But when I took it up at 41 at the first lesson, he says I asked, how old is too old to go to the Olympics at archery? Before I had shot the thing. So that's, yeah, I go too far with everything. But I picked it up pretty quickly, yeah. I mean, it was between when I took it up and was a semifinalist for the Olympic team was 2.5 years. So I picked it up pretty quick.
I mean, it took me 5 years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Twice as long.
Twice as long.
Yeah.
See? I guess I didn't have your natural talent. As someone who you've described yourself as someone who wants everyone to like you, or wanted everyone to like you, were you able to quiet the kind of natural self-criticism?
That's a very insightful question, because that is a huge part of it. Soon after I started, I had an excellent coach, Don Rabska, and soon into the training, I'd shoot and he'd say suddenly, "What were you just thinking?" And I'd have to think, and I'd say, I was thinking I suck. And then another time he'd ask me, and I'd say, I was thinking you think I suck. And I realized that I hadn't really been aware of my self-talk until then, and I became hyper-aware and realized that I was just constantly putting myself down every minute. And not only just in archery, but all day long, everywhere. And so I really tried to conquer it, and every time I just became aware when I, particularly in archery, obviously first, if I was thinking, oh, that sucked, I suck, I can't, I think, no, it didn't, I'm doing the best I can, I'll be better tomorrow, I'm doing the best I can. And it bled over into my real life too, because it was so overwhelming, the amount of negative self-talk that I had going on. It was like having an unnecessary person beating me up all day, you know. And I know that everybody, you know, has some degree of problem with this, but it really changed my life because the intense degree that I had, you know, this inner critic going on.
Do you feel like the way that that change in your life, that you, like, left, you didn't act very much for a while, you went and semi-qualified for the Olympics in archery, and it had this pretty profound impact on the way that you lived your life.
Right.
When you were a full-on grown-up.
Right. That's true.
You'd been married several times before, but you a lasting marriage with children in your personal life and in your professional life. This commitment to, you know, to doing this hard work to you know, make this industry better.
Well, it definitely has impacted everything in a positive way. It's just made me so much more confident, like working with Susan Sarandon and having her be a role model, you know, had a huge impact on me. It all just made me feel like it's okay to be me. It's okay to take up space in the world. It's I feel comfortable speaking up and doing things that I think are important. So yeah, I think it had a big impact. Also, archery afforded me an opportunity to experience success that was measurable rather than subjective, which everything is in this industry. But it was suddenly like, oh, it doesn't matter what I look like while I'm doing it or what I'm wearing. It's only the points. And I had never done something except schoolwork, you know, that was measured in numbers. And I loved that about it. I really, really liked that about it.
Well, I mean, you say, like, I think even above and beyond the part about it being objective rather than subjective, generally, you know, I think that the experience of subjectivity for an actress is very different than it is for an actor, but for many other people, you know, a visual artist or something like that, whose work is seen because of sexism, because so much of the work is tied up in, you know, in a sexist system and the male gaze.
Right. Absolutely.
Do you feel like the work that you're doing now is changing things?
Yes, I do. I'm very optimistic.
You're very optimistic based on experience or very optimistic by nature?
No. Well, I think by nature too, but But no, I can be very, I can look at things very clinically, but based on the experiences that we've had and the response that we've gotten, I'm very optimistic that no matter how intractable this problem has been and how invisible it's been, profoundly invisible, it's now getting noticed and that people are willing to make changes. And so finally, I do believe that very soon we'll get momentum going as far as on-screen portrayals. I can't promise that we're going to have momentum behind the scenes anytime soon. That's a much tougher nut to crack, you know, in the directing and writing and producing.
When you go and talk to good-hearted, well-meaning people who agree that it's a problem and are surprised at the extent to which it's a problem, what do you ask them or to change or suggest that they change specifically? Like, what are the actions that you would have them take?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because it's very specifically not, please make more movies starring a female character. I think if that was my goal, it would be very hard. It would be very hard slog because you've probably run into this, the concept that women will watch men, but men won't watch women, so it's not our fault. We have to make everybody male in the lead characters. And no matter how many movies starring women come out that are successes, we never seem to get momentum going. I think it's because there's this just fear that that's true, and so we can't do that. And those movies must be a one-off. So I don't say that. What I say is whatever you're going to make, whatever you're already going to make, I'm not saying add a message, do anything different. Whatever you're already making, before you cast it, go through and change a bunch of first names to female and add some diversity in there. To, and wherever it says a crowd gathers, put comma, which is half female. And there you have it. You've got a gender balanced script probably. It might be more interesting now that some of the characters have had a gender swap because they won't be stereotyped clearly if they were meant to be a man. And it's easy and it's fun, simple. Ultimately, we want writers to write parts for women. And it's great when they do write incredible, well-drawn characters for women, but it doesn't happen anywhere near enough, and it'd be simple enough in so many, many cases. There's very few characters that couldn't be either a man or a woman.
Well, Gina Davis, I'm so grateful that you came in to talk to us today. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. The other thing I say to them is figure out what part I'm going to play. Because I like to work.
Gina Davis founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media, and she's also founded the Bentonville Film Festival in Arkansas, a film festival dedicated to promoting gender equality and diversity in film, which is one of, if not the only, film festival in the world that guarantees distribution to its winners.
It is. It's the only one. Yeah, you get theatrical, TV, digital, and DVD release.
The whole nine yards, in
all
other
words. Of it, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Louis C.K.'s always made things himself. He used to make short films, the kind that don't really get released anywhere, back when he was a comedy writer and beginning stand-up. When he got the deal to make his FX show, Louis, which has been incredibly critically acclaimed, it was basically with the condition that he could make whatever he wanted. He's made and distributed his last few comedy specials himself, and now he's made his own TV show with his own money for his website. Horace and Pete is about brothers, two in a long line who run a bar in Brooklyn. Here's a scene from the show. Horace explains to a customer, that's Horace is Louis C.K.'s character, why he's being charged extra for a beer.
You all right? What's up?
Yeah, I was charged $4.50 for Budweiser. Yeah. That guy was charged $3. Just not sure why the discrepancy.
He's been coming here a long time.
Oh, so is that a privilege for just that one guy, or is like more people that
some
get to
people,
pay?
Some people pay $450, some people pay $3.
Okay. How do you decide that? Is there like a list, or?
If he looks like him, he pays $3. If he looks like you, he pays $450.
So just out-and-out discrimination? Are you aware how totally unfair and not okay that is? I'm not sure what group. I mean, I'm Jewish. I'm gay.
Here's the thing. You're getting more for your money than he is.
How so?
Because, well, see, you come here and you make fun of the place because it's an old Brooklyn dive bar, so you and your friends get to enjoy that part of it, and then also you get to have a beer. But he just gets the beer. See, you're here ironically, but he's really here because he just lives on the corner.
Horace and Pete's 10 episodes are on louisck.com. Louis C.K., welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
This is maybe the quietest television show I've ever watched.
Yeah, that sounds true, yeah. It is. There's very little track. There's very little ambience track. And there's no score to speak of.
I had noticed in the first episode that there was basically no music in the show, mm-hmm. although there was a little like diegetic music on a bar jukebox or something, I think maybe in the first episode. But mm-hmm. In the second episode, there was a scene where your character and your character's daughter are having a chat on a park bench, mm-hmm. and it was dead silent.
Yes. Yeah, it was almost like a soap opera when they do outdoor scenes. It's just weird. Yeah, it needed to feel like a stage play for me, and I didn't want to. I figured the more production value I add to it in terms of building sound and stuff, the further away it was getting from this one idea. So I thought it was better to just let people get accustomed to grow immune to it or whatever it is or just start to feel it.
There was a scene in the second episode where Edie Falco enters and has a long exchange with the people behind the bar, and it's silent. And there's no music and mm-hmm. no anything. And my wife and I were joking with each other that probably that part in the screen said, actors act.
Oh, you mean like a closed captions or something? Or
no,
what?
No, like the stage direction said, E. Falco enters.
Actors act.
Actors act. And then the dialogue.
Right. What was the scene? I don't remember that.
It was.
She talks to the customers?
She's mad about something when she mm-hmm. enters. She looks at Steve Buscemi's character, I think.
No, that's right. Okay. Yes, it was all silent.
Yeah.
Because what it was is the episode before she had this huge confrontation where she's suing her family members, which happens. And then now she's coming back to just try to live normal life, come in and out, flow with her family who she's in legal dispute with. And Uncle Pete and her had terrible words. So it was Uncle Pete, it was Alan Alda's character. So she walks in and it's scripted. All the beats are scripted that she walks in and looks at him in a sort of testing way with, you know, she's guarded, but she's looking at him and he smiles at her. And so she softens. She says, "Hi, Pete." And then he frowns. And then she feels like he trapped her, which he did. So then she says, she curses and then goes upstairs.
So I hear you say that you wanted it to feel like a stage play. It has the production qualities of a television show. It mm-hmm. doesn't feel like you're watching great performances.
No. Yeah, it's different than that. Yeah.
But why did you want it to feel like a play? And if you wanted it to feel like a play, why did you want it to feel like a play that did not have an audience?
Yeah, that's a really interesting distinction. And I thought about that because – I mean, I started to realize that I wasn't trying to emulate anything. I was trying to take pieces from each kind of experience. So when you watch a play, you're in an audience. And not only are you in an audience, you're in a separate world from the stage. You're in this dark place. And you're also in a community. You're with a group of people. And it's you and them. It's still a one-on-one relationship, you to the play. But also you are in this quiet, respectfully hushed community.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Louis C.K. He's best known for his Emmy-winning TV show, Louie. He's got a new show, which he made himself in secret. It's called Horace and Pete. It's available at louisck.com. Can I ask you something about Alan Alda?
Ask me anything you want about Alan Alda.
Great. That's the promise I've always wanted to hear. So
doesn't mean I'm going to answer it, but I don't think I know anything about him that nobody should know. I don't have any bad secrets.
You didn't see him do something awful.
No, I didn't
see him sell some secrets to the Soviets.
No, I didn't have to back out of a room slowly of Alan Alda.
So I don't think Alan Alda is unusual in this cast in his acting ability. You have some really brilliant actors in this show, basically everyone except you.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
But, you know,
that's
like,
why I have almost no lines. I just listen to everybody.
Edie, that's you do a really impressive job of that. That is a hard acting thing.
It's not that hard. Anyway, go on.
But like, you know, Edie Falco's no joke. You know what I mean?
No.
But of all the people in your show, Alan Alda is the only one who I can't imagine being a real person. I know he's a real person, and I've seen him host the PBS show Scientific American Frontiers.
Yeah.
So like, I know he's not a character.
Right.
You put Alan Alda in your show not to do Alan Alda stuff.
Mm-mm.
So how on earth did you end up there?
Well, there's certain times you cast. Casting is a very tricky thing, and it's one of the things I love most about doing this stuff. And casting this show was, you know, 60% of the whole ballgame. And Alan was a different case than everybody else. Steve Buscemi's part was written for him, and so was Edie's, and even Jessica Lange's. Everybody was kind of had people in mind. And there's been a few people. There's a few of the big characters in the show that were written for somebody, and they couldn't do it. And then I found someone else. So you sort of, but if you go with what you see in your mind, you can't do that 100% because no human being fits that. So you want to have somebody who adds something you didn't expect, right? There's all kinds of things. But Alan was a totally different case, which is just that he's great. I've always loved him, and I've always thought he had tremendous range and diversity. I mean, for a lot of people, the Alan Alda trip was going from MASH, which I grew up with, to Crimes and Misdemeanors, his part in that he was just a jerk, this really narcissistic jerk. And it was like, but that's Hawkeye. I love Hawkeye. That's not Hawkeye at all, but I love this character. And then he started to repeat that. And, you know, on West Wing, when he played this erstwhile Republican senator, and yet you got to see his vulnerabilities and stuff and tons of things. I just think he's a huge talent, a great, great artist. That's why I hired him. Not because I thought he looked like Uncle Pete or sounded like him. I actually didn't think he did. But I thought, and then he wanted the job. He wanted it. So somebody's desire to do a thing plus their ability, you just go, he'll do something. I just know that this guy, and I had time. I cast him way back in, feels like it was September. So I felt like his brain plus time equals great work. I don't care what he comes up with. So I really just trusted him. And every time that we read together, he asked for lots of time to read. Any opportunity I would give him, I'd go to his house. He'd come to my house. We had table reads. Every time he read it, he got better and better. He sculpted it and sculpted it. So
it must have been kind of amazing to basically invite like Edie Falco and Steve Buscemi, all these brilliant actors and actresses. Basically, just be like, "Hey, you guys want to come over to my house and do a play?"
It was weird, and because the project was secret, and I didn't really make official deals with these people for a while, it felt really strange because it did feel like they're just coming over my house, and I read this stuff. It didn't feel real for a long time, and also because we couldn't shoot until we were going in the air, so all the preparation was like a play, you know, although not as intense where you go to rehearsal every day for 4 weeks or whatever those people do. But yeah, they would all just come over and we'd all be a little awkward because we know each other to varying degrees and some not. And then we'd read it and then they'd go home. That's it. And then I would think about what happened at the reading and maybe make some adjustments. Usually I didn't. I just wanted them to know it better and better. So
were you scared to do this?
No, I don't think there was fear. I mean, I had I was just couldn't wait to do it. I was going crazy that I wanted to get started. And yet I really valued the time that I had to prepare to get it right. The thing that started to happen is the more high caliber the cast got and the higher my hopes got for what the show could be. Like when they built the bar, the first day I went to the bar in the set, it took my breath away. I was so happy with that bar and every detail in it. Every time something got added, it's like, this, now that's good. Now that's really good. Even when this guy in the art department, I wish I knew his name, he painted the Horace and Pete sign. And it was beautiful to me. And when I got Paul Simon to do the song, and once I had a CD of Paul Simon's song that he made for us, I thought, Jesus, this is a tremendous thing this could be. Could be. That I had anxiety because of that, waiting for it to happen. And also because I was trying to keep it all secret. There was this huge, crazy pressure cooker of, I don't want anybody to even know a whisper of this. And I wanted that because that's the way I wanted the audience to see it. I wanted them to see it without the slightest idea what they're going to see every second. I wanted them not to know anybody who's seen it or have heard or read something about it. I wanted them, the only thing I thought they'll know is they can check their little timeline and see that it's 65 minutes, but otherwise they don't know anything. Who's going to pop up on screen? How long things are going to go? So I was going a little nuts. I had to do a lot of mind yoga and exercised a lot. I tried to take better care of myself so that I could handle that part, but it wasn't fear.
Can you define mind yoga for me?
Mind yoga? Well, you know, like just trying to be deliberate about getting a lot of sleep and taking care of myself. And then the week we started, that's when I got scared because I thought, well, this might not work because.
Right. I mean, this is the part that I think you're leaving unaddressed is.
Yeah, sure.
Were you scared that you were going to do a bad job?
As an actor?
Any part of it.
Oh, sure. Yes. I
you're responsible for a number of different things, yeah, in this bunch production, of things. Louis.
Well, I do have confidence in that I can do certain things. And I did. This show was a combination of a lot of things I've done already. And I've done them at least competently. At least I know how to do them. So I know how to bring actors together and direct. There were some things I had never done. I've never done anything like a play. I've never led a rehearsal, ever. I mean, when I shot my show, Louis, we didn't hold rehearsals. People would just come to the set, and they'd always have this bewildered look like, am I going to get a chance to run this? And I've had many actors come up to me and go, so how are we doing this? I'm going, we're shooting first take. We're shooting it. And maybe something will happen. We want to use it. And you'd see them get upset. But I've learned that it's okay for an actor to get upset and go back to their trailer and go, oh, my God, this is intense. They'll be okay. The pressure's good for performers, you know?
I would be worried that I would do something and not do a good job and Edie Falco wouldn't like me anymore.
Yes. Well, I don't worry about people not liking me because it's all – I've had plenty of bad experiences to train for that. It's just what happens. But I did think I wanted not to let those actors down. Of course, I had apprehension about how am I going to measure up to this group. What am I going to give them that's any use to them? And I'm inventing something. So there isn't a way to do this when all the pieces came together. But I've directed, I've shot, I did a multi-camera show with Lucky Louie. I wrote these things and I felt very good about the writing. I felt the writing was really solid. There were some scenes I was like, I don't know how that one's going to work. I didn't know, you don't know anything until you start seeing it go. And the essence of this project was that as we rehearsed, it would start in a bad, rough place. The first time you read something, it's not right. It's nobody knows what they're doing yet, and no one's connecting yet, and it's out of sync. So the first version you see stinks, and you have to go like, it's all right, it'll get better. But episode one, it was hard to have that because I didn't know if the whole mechanism worked. But that idea that the whole thing might have been shouldn't have done it creatively – was exciting. That to me, I like to be in that unknown, you know. And I have directed quite a few heavyweight people. So I've had that moment of like the guy comes to the set, he's cranky because he didn't like his room or whatever, you know, and you just meet him and make him feel comfortable. I mean, I directed David Lynch and all kinds of people that no one's directed before in that kind of context. So I'm used to that. I'm used to kind of keeping an even heart rate while talking to somebody who's like a big deal to me and being of use to them. Not just like, you know, if somebody big shows up and you go like, I'm such a huge fan, you just see them look at you like, hey, you're not going to be any help to me, you know. They're actors. They wanted to be directed. And it was very much a collaboration. I gave everybody notes, but they were spare. And then we would all talk as a group and go, feels good. Feels like something. I mean, we ran it a bunch of times the first day, the first episode. And then we all looked at each other and said, this is starting to work. This is starting to work. And I said, yeah, let's go home. And then we just did that every day till we shot it.
I mean, you were inspired in part by Mike Lee. And mm-hmm. Mike Lee is a director who is most famous for his films, but started in theater and is famous for, I mean, the thing that I am often moved by in his movies, is one of my faves, is the kind of humanity and intimacy of his movies, a type of reality that you don't it's a theatrical reality that feels so true mm-hmm. That you don't get to see a lot in movies.
That's right.
His process involves basically putting everyone in a room and working out the entire thing over the course of months and months and months.
That's right. That's right. That's what a lot of people do. And I think that whatever you do when you make theater or television or whatever, you fit into the schedule you're given. Whatever the demand is, you figure it out. You know, when I wrote for Conan, we did 5 shows a week, an hour each, at least one piece of full-fledged comedy per show. It was just backbreaking. But we did it. We did it every day. Every day we made comedy. And then I worked on the Chris Rock show, and it was half an hour, and it was one a week. And so there was really only one or two pieces of comedy that had to be executed every week. It felt really hard, you know? So whatever amount of time you have, you'll use it. So this show was 1 week to execute a full-fledged play-like script. But we had a rhythm to it. And we got better as we went along, I think. Sometimes I think I wish I could have gone back, but there's also a linear logic to the show being rough in the beginning and then smoothing towards the end.
I'll finish my conversation with Louis C.K. after a break. He'll tell me why he decided to self-finance and distribute his show, Horace and Pete. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message comes from Target, who bring you this message. If you haven't yet, you have to check out Made to Matter, handpicked by Target. There's a natural wool dryer ball from Baby Gannix that cuts drying time up to 25% and lasts for 1,000 loads. And Bitsy's Brain Food has a line of USDA organic crackers that have half a serving of veggies in each serving. And they're made in a nut-free bakery. Check out all the better-for-you products from Made to Matter at target.com/made-to-matter. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Let me introduce you to NPR Music's discovery podcast, Alt Latino. Hosts Felix Contreras and Jasmine Gard are your guides into the world of Latino arts and culture. And they're not taking a stodgy museum tour. Alternative approaches to traditional music, interviews with cultural icons like Rita Moreno and Carlos Santana, as well as contemporary vanguards like Calle 13 and Juno Diaz. Find Alt Latino at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the comedian, writer, and director Louis C.K. He stars in his new show alongside Alan Alda, Steve Buscemi, and Jessica Lange. Let's take a listen to another little bit of Horace and Pete, which is Louis C.K.'s new television show on his website, louisck.com. Steve Buscemi's character is Pete. He plays the brother of Louis C.K.'s character. And this woman visits him at the bar. Her name's Trisha. The two of them met in the mental hospital.
That's right.
And she seems really lovely. She also has Tourette's. She has an outburst in the middle of the bar. And so you'll hear Pete talking to Horace and Uncle Pete, who's played by Alan Alda, who's kind of the what passes for a paterfamilias, right? Like a sort mm-hmm. of weird, gross, awful, mean uncle dad.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Come on, she's a wacko, but she's very nice. And anyway, she obviously likes you. And, you know, anyway, you're... I mean,
what? I'm what? No, what? Well, you think just because she's got a disorder and I got my thing that I have to be with her? What the f*** is that? I got to stick with my own kind? Just stay away from the normal girls, Pete. Just stay with your own up kind, Pete.
I'm not saying any of that.
I am. Makes sense. I mean, you two whack jobs should go together. Just don't have any babies.
What I'm saying is that she's cute and she's nice and she likes you and you're 52. So how many more times is that going to happen for you?
Look, I knew her at the hospital. We're not there anymore. That's that.
So it was in the news. You went on Howard Stern and talked about how you paid for this production yourself, mm-hmm. and it put you in debt. Yeah. I think maybe the news cycle interpreted that as Louis C.K. spent all his money on this show, when I think it's probably more reasonable to say basically all businesses have capital expenditures and yes. they generally pay for those with debt.
Exactly. No, it was a funny thing because I even said in the interview, I went into debt and it'll be gone by summer, which is an enormous – that's a huge turnaround. That's a great result. But it's more fun to just take – you know, he lost his money. It's like if you invested in something, like you bought a building and your plan is I'm going to buy this building. I'm going to spend $3 million on this building, flip it, and then sell it for $6 million. And then the day you write the check for $3 million, he lost $3 million. He lost $3 million. So it was curious to see how that happened. That kind of BuzzFeed, that press, that news cycle thing has gotten really strange. So it was weird to see how it came out. It didn't hurt me any. You know, the boosted sales went through the roof the day that came out. But yeah, the show's very healthy right now. I mean, it's on its way to paying for itself. And the sales increase as time goes by. So, and then I'll, you know, sell it to other outlets and, you know.
What was the reason that you decided to pay for it with your own money, even if it was money that you felt like you were going to get back?
I don't need a lot of money to feel good. I don't. And I don't need
to me.
Well, money is a resource to me. It's a element. It's like oxygen or water. It's something that you can make stuff with. I've always viewed it that way. And when I climbed in income in the last few years, I got some things that I wanted, and I'm done. I'm fine. I want security for my kids, but at the same time, that I don't hold as dear to that as other people do. Like, I want my kids not to worry about anything. That's a bizarre desire for me. You know, money is something to use in the present. I don't want to be homeless. Like, that's my one thing. I still always think someday I might. When I look like a frostbitten homeless guy, I'm like, that's could still be me. I still have that worry. I grew up poor, and this party that makes you not afraid to be poor ever, which is powerful. And the other side is you really don't want to be poor again. So.
Well, I think you also don't. One time on my way to my sophomore year of college, mm-hmm. my dad just told me this story about this part of his life where he was homeless.
Yeah.
And I was
wow. Oh, my God. That's intense. Yes, then you feel the ground open up beneath your feet.
But I understand. I understand very much the idea that the idea of the feeling that, like, what you want to achieve is a certain amount of security, but that beyond that, there's not that much difference between a nice apartment and a really nice apartment.
No, that's how I feel. I've got enough. And then when I look at the money and I look at whether I take on money or not, there's a few ways to get money. You can take on debt. You can buy money that you don't have. Bizarre idea to me, but it does work. And then the other one is ask someone to invest and be a partner with you. That's what I knew I didn't want to do.
Why is that?
Because I didn't want to convince anybody of any of the ideas I had for this show and where I wanted to take it.
Because you didn't want to go through the process of doing that? You didn't want people to change it? You didn't. Which part of it?
Well, because I didn't want the stress of convincing people. And I also didn't want to take a risk with other people. I felt, I don't know, not morally, but I felt like it wasn't fair to take someone else's money with any confidence that they'd get it back and then play with this thing the way that I did. Because to me, it was so worthwhile to do this show in a way that was very counterintuitive financially. Every time I've put something on my website, like when I did the Beacon special, I went on Conan and said, here it comes. And there was a pent-up interest that really boosted sales. People like to line up for an iPhone, even though they can get one, you know, a week later without waiting in line. It has always increased sales on my website to announce things first. But I didn't do that. That was an enormous financial mistake if you're looking at it from that point of view. But I knew that. I knew that going in. I launched the show on Saturday mornings, which is you can't, it's the dark side of the moon for the cycle, you know, for viral sort of. I wanted people to share the show with each other. And I wanted people to either see it because I told them about it or because someone wrote them and said, I know you and I know you would love this. Like, I wanted it to grow that way. I just wanted to see how that goes, like how that goes. I thought it was worthwhile. And I kept making different decisions like that as I went along. I didn't want a partner to go, hey, man, I'm not going to do any press. None. I'm not going to do any press. Well, now the show's on the air and it's getting reviews. Do some press. Nah. Make a trailer. I don't want to do – I didn't want to have a conversation with anybody except myself. And so, yeah, when I started, my hope was that the show's sales would feed the show. But as soon as it started, I realized, well, this is a different deal here. The other things I've made have exploded sales-wise because I did it to sell. This I did differently. So I have to live with the fact that my audience is smaller than what I'm used to. But it feels so good. Like, it was so fun. And then I would see the audience grow every week. And I thought, I want this to keep going organically. And also, I knew this isn't over. I'm going to go out and promote when it's done. I had that idea from the beginning. Once the whole show's done, I'll hit the pavement hard and promote it.
I was trying to remember what the last time you were on the show was. And I remember that you definitely were on for your show Lucky Louie, mm-hmm. which was a multi-camera sitcom on premium cable.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking about watching that show, and it a lot of things worked about it. Some things didn't.
Yeah. It was a mixed bag, yeah.
Yeah. I like the show in general and don't want to present it as a failure for that reason. But mm-hmm. Some things didn't work about it. One of the things that worked less good was you were not a very good actor in it.
That was terrible, yeah.
There was something, like, you were funny in it and stuff.
Yeah, but in moments. But I didn't know how to listen and act at all.
So in part of what this show is, to my eyes, mm-hmm. is you putting yourself in a position to not only have to do comic acting but also real powerful emotional acting. I'm not talking about yelling on the waterfront mm-hmm. monologues, but like real emotional acting. Mm-hmm. And did you feel confident that you could do that?
No. I wasn't sure I would step up, especially considering who I was working with. But we were a family, and it felt like it on the show. I don't mean family like the way people say that about every production. We're really a family. I mean like that family that we were playing. And I had my place in that family. And also, I thought very differently about this show because I knew it was this 10-part thing and we're not going to give you everything every episode. There's all these things that happen in series television. Like, you kind of want everything to pay off the same way every episode. You want to know this character does this, so this is what this character does. And I remember when I looked at the first episode of Horace and Pete, the script, I thought, Horace isn't really developed in this episode. He's developed much more in the second episode. And I thought, that's okay. Leave it that way. And then Horace is revealed a little bit more way down. I think it's episode 7. I mean, episode 3, you hear more backstory because you meet his ex-wife. Then episode 7, he tells a stranger a huge secret about himself. Then you see him tested when his brother disappears because he's a very immobile person emotionally. He's kind of shut down. But when his brother disappears, he becomes unhinged. So I didn't mind it. I didn't feel like you had to see front load all that stuff. You'll find it if you stick with it. If you don't, you don't. I'm lucky I put a lot of the really heavy stuff towards the end because by the time it got there to episode 8 and 9, when Pete starts to become, you know, when things get intense, I felt who I was in the show and I was very attached to Steve Buscemi and I felt a relationship with Sylvia as a sister and all this stuff. So I didn't really act. I just felt all those things.
My guest is Louis C.K. We're talking about his show Horace and Pete, which he self-financed and self-distributed. Let's listen to another clip from the show. In this scene, Horace is talking to his ex, Sarah, who's played by Laurie Metcalf. She's cheated on her second husband. She's trying to find some solace.
What am I?
You're just like a whole bunch of other people, Sarah. Like a lot of other people. Like you could field an army with how many people have been in your situation. Literally, you could gather the cheaters of the world and you could wage war on the honest, and you'd win.
Oh, God, you're awful.
You're going to be okay, you know. It's going to be okay. You're going to be okay, Sarah.
Well, I don't know how you know that.
Because, you know how I know it? Because I'm okay. And I was right where you are. And I'm okay.
What about Glenn?
He'll be okay, too. Because he is where you were. And you're okay.
Yeah.
And his kids will be fine. Because look at our kids.
Sometimes before I do one of these interviews, I'll look at like the Wikipedia entry or like, you know, TVwhatever.com just to remind myself like what the characters' names are because I will forget. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that your character, Horace's last name was Whittle, which I don't think I had noticed in watching the show.
Yeah, the whole family is the Whittle family.
And I don't think I'd put that together or heard it together. And there was a comedy writer and, you know, sometime performer named Harris Whittles who died about a year ago.
Yep.
Who's very beloved in the Los Angeles comedy scene particularly.
Yep.
And I know you'd worked with him. Was that an homage?
Yeah. When I started writing the show, I didn't have a last name. I just had the first names. And then the first time in the first episode, because there was a legal dispute, the lawyer says the family name. And I stopped writing and went, what's their last name? And I thought, something Irish, I guess. Feels like an Irish bar. I don't want it to be McSorley or something. Or, you know, I didn't want to do an Irish name. And then I just thought about Whittle. I thought about Harris. I don't know why. I will really miss him. I was very sad when he died. Sorry. But it's funny, I didn't have much contact with him his last year or so of life, but it's just a bummer because he, you know, died from heroin, and I've lost a crazy amount of friends that way. I don't think you should know more than one person who died of a heroin overdose in your lifetime, and I think I've known 4 or 5 who died from heroin, and it's such a losing battle. I mean, when somebody knows that drug, it's just a time clock. How long can they last? But anyway, yeah, Harris was a really good guy, and he was a real, you know, he was a real demon, you know. He had demons, but he was also, you know, he was a real bastard, like in his own way. And he laid out his crazy, gross self for all of us that knew him, and everybody accepted him. Everybody loved him. He was a communally loved guy. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know why his name hit me in the head when I was writing it, but I was like, yeah, let's give Harris, let's give them his last name. So that's how it became Harris Whittle, Horace Whittle. Horace was first. I didn't think of his, you know what I mean? It was really his last name. And then I realized it sounds like Horace Whittle, Harris Whittle. Yeah, why not? Anyway, yep.
Well, Louis, I don't want to take up more of your time, but I really appreciate you making the trip over and coming back.
Sure, man.
Show.
Happy to do it. I love listening to this show. It's really fun. I listen to it all the time. NPR is my house soundtrack. I just have it on all the time, and I'm always happy when you come on. Oh, you always do really great interviews with people. So, and I enjoyed it last time I was here. So,
Louis C.K.'s new show is called Horace and Pete. It's on louisck.com right now, and you can watch all 10 episodes.
Yep.
Every week we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. So there's a website. It's called Zombo.com. When you visit Zombo.com, you see a sort of lo-fi picture of a flower, like really lo-fi, like somebody made it with some circles from Microsoft Paint. And it's sort of animated, like it blinks. And at the top, there's this header. It's this key lime green gradient and Zombo.com written in a font that looks like you would use it for a preschool carnival. Oh, and one other thing on Zombo.com. It plays this sound.
Welcome to Zombo.com. This is Zombo.com. Welcome. This is Zombo.com. Welcome to ZomboCom. You can do anything at ZomboCon. Anything at all.
That, by the way, just goes on and on. One time I made it to the end, but it seriously took me leaving my computer and coming back.
Welcome to ZomboCon.
Anyway, this website, it's been the same for coming up on 20 years. This same strange, beautiful dream from when the web was a baby and everybody was full of promises. I guess it's not a hilarious joke exactly. I mean, even in 1999, it wasn't exactly Oscar Wilde. And those flash splash pages that used to be on websites, the thing that it parodies, I guess don't even really exist anymore. But I still visit once in a while just to make sure there's something on the internet that'll always be the same. It's nice to visit an old friend. That's my outshot.
Welcome to ZomboCon. This is ZomboCon. Welcome to ZomboCon. Welcome. This is ZomboCon. Welcome to ZomboCon.
We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Anything is possible on Bullseye. You can do anything on Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abadia Nexborello. Our production assistant is Christian Duenas. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. Help this week from Jennifer Marmer. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally, thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if you want to hear about more cool culture stuff, check out our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. It's a roundtable discussion of everything great in popular culture, hosted by comedian Guy Branum. That's right, everything great, not just Zombo.com. This week, the team remember Prince, and they react to Beyoncé's visual album, Lemonade. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast. This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Don't get caught without emergency medical coverage on an international trip. Learn how Allianz Travel Insurance can protect your trip from the unexpected at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.